and nobody wanted to spend time with the Tal Shiar. Their reach, their power. He did not think that even his family connections would protect him. But each night as he lay in bed and tried to sleep, his mind would soon wander to thinking about the horrors of what Romulus would soon face. Somebody, somewhere, had to be doing something. But who? What? Where? At length, he couldn't bear the uncertainty any longer. He had to have news, but whom could he ask? He did not trust the propaganda that his government was putting out, which assured the people of Romulus that everything was fine, that evacuation plans were well underway, and they should wait to hear from local officials about their designated departure dates. He did not believe the footage that he saw of happy Romulans settling into bright new homes on bright new worlds. He did not trust colleagues either, or those that remained. He assumed half of them were Tal Shiar, and the rest were either paid off or intimidated. He knew that he needed external confirmation of his work, someone objective who could tell him that his predictions were right. The name came to him one night when he had gone to bed early, there being no light, no power, and no food, and he lay hungry and restless, listening to disruptor fire on the far side of the city. Safadi. She would know what was happening. She was an expert. As soon as he thought this, he tried to put the idea out of his mind. It was madness, he thought. There was no way that he could contact her. But who else was there? Who else could tell him that his work was accurate? Who else could he ask? He spent a great deal of his personal fortune on getting the communication arranged. An uncle, who had always had a soft spot for him, who had indulged the boy's eccentricities for many years, and who happened to own a fleet of ships that operated along the border, agreed to send the message for him via his Federation contacts, for a fair price. So Vritet sent his message, written in both desperation and hope, to Amal Safadi on Earth. Please confirm you have seen my work and agree. Please confirm help is on its way. And then, back home to wait. Hope that somehow the message would get through. Hope that it got through undetected. Hope that whoever she was working with in her own intelligence services had the ability to see that this was not a fake, and had the skill to use the information encrypted in his message to send the response back safely. He waited, and he waited. At last, there came a knock at the door. About 10 minutes later, Vritet sat in the back of a vehicle speeding through the city, wedged between two Tal Shiar agents. They had hit him very hard and then put a hood over his head. They had dragged him down the stairs, his legs crumpled beneath him. They pushed him into the back of this vehicle and made him sit with his head down between his knees and his hands clasped behind his neck. All through this, particularly after they had hit him, his mind had floated away. He thought, did I think it would end this way? And he knew that half of him had, and half of him had not. That dual world all Romulans inhabited, one of reality, one of self-deception. At last, after time had lost meaning to Vritet, and he had passed into limbo, the vehicle stopped. He was bundled out and dragged inside, and then marched. Where? For a long time, down echoing corridors, up flights of stairs, down more flights of stairs. He tried to tell himself that all of this was simply an attempt to disorient him, to frighten him. The problem was, it worked. It worked very well. And it ended where it was always going to end. Vritet strapped in a chair, with lights shining in his eyes, and two shadowy figures behind the lights talking to him.
Take us through your calculations. We believe there are errors. We would like you to outline these for us.
Through parched lips and a broken nose, he said, There are no errors.
Try again, Nokim. There are certainly errors here.
There are no errors.
Look harder. You will find them if you look closely enough.
Look harder, Nokim. If you try very hard, you will see your mistake.
Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. After his conversation with Jurati, Maddox went to ground. She left him message after message, and he would think, "This isn't fair. I must get back to her." But then he would open up his files and turn back to his work, and he would become lost. He would become lost to everything except the pursuit of his beautiful, elusive dream. Dimly, he perceived that this change in his habits was not going unnoticed. Even Sisra Coas, the rather shambolic director of the Institute, had left him a handful of cordial and circumlocutory messages that he knew were asking, "Where the hell are you, Bruce?" Estella McKenzie, keen to get started on the next generation of synths, was plaguing him almost hourly, it seemed. And then the messages started to arrive from Geordi LaForge. "What's going on, Bruce? Where are you?" But he could not put his work aside. This idea, this brilliant idea of fractal neuronic cloning, he knew that there was something there, and the thought of this consumed him. He felt like a boy again, poring over the books and data files, utterly absorbed, forgetting the time and everything around him. He began to remember how it felt to be caught up in ideas, to be pursuing a breakthrough. The need to be wholly immersed, to be without distractions, to absent oneself so thoroughly from the world around you. He took long walks out into the countryside around the Institute. He turned off his handheld, his calm at home, and then his calm at work. Somewhere in the peace and quiet lay the answers he had been looking for all his life. He was utterly unprepared for Geordi LaForge's arrival. A summer morning, very hot. Maddox getting to his office late and distracted. LaForge standing outside his locked door, arms folded. "Hey, Bruce, what's going on?" The whole day lost to this. He remembered the story of Coleridge, waking from a fever dream with the whole of Kublai Khan inside his head, sitting at his desk and getting down only a few lines before there was a knock at the door and a person from Porlock kept him talking until the poem was well and truly dead. LaForge put him through his paces. He wanted a full tour. He wanted detailed reports. He wanted the team heads in. He wanted to hear everything they had to say. He wanted to know how the next generation was coming along. He wanted 50 more synths as quickly as possible. Maddox hardly heard a word of it. "Bruce," said LaForge partway through the afternoon, "are you even listening?" Maddox looked up. The whole team was staring at him. LaForge looked pissed off. "I have to get a grip. Just for today." "Of course I am, Geordi," he said, and he pulled his mind back to whatever the man wanted. That night, the team took their visitor out for dinner. 14 of them, plus Maddox and LaForge, a very cheerful and lively occasion. Agnes sat at the far end of the table looking sad, and he smiled at her until she began to glow ever so slightly. "Get through this evening," Maddox was thinking, "and you can get back to work." On the way out of the restaurant, Agnes brushed past him, smiling brightly, and said in a quiet voice that only he could hear, "Are you okay? Have I done something wrong?" He touched her arm. "Everything's okay, Aggie. Work." And he left it at that because he did not want a long conversation. He did not want distractions. As soon as he was sure that LaForge was content, he hurried off back to his apartment. He listened to yet another message from Agnes. "Hey, I know you said everything was okay, and so, I don't mean to hassle you. Wondered if a coffee might be on the agenda soon?" He promised himself he would reply to her in the morning. He was afraid, terribly afraid, that if he lost the thread, he would never find it again. Maddox lay down. The night was hot, and the temperature regulators were struggling. Through the open window, he heard the endless chirrup of the evening cicadas. He closed his eyes, but he did not see darkness. Instead, he saw fractals. He saw them vividly, lit up, golden rays and spirals that began to spin, that drew him in ever deeper and deeper. He knew he might lose himself inside this maze. And he knew that this was what he wanted, because the deeper he went, the better he would understand. And somewhere in this maze, he knew he would find the key. In the dark, eyes closed, he pressed the thumb and forefinger of each hand together, forming circles. Then he pushed the circles together so that they interlocked. The key, he thought. The key to unlocking life. Part 3. The Last. 2385. 11.
Admiral's log. Reports have been reaching us that the situation on the Romulan homeworld is deteriorating rapidly. Significant changes in climate and the concomitant strains are leading to an infrastructure breakdown. I cannot imagine what conditions must be like on Romulus as a result of this. Highly complex civilizations, reliant as they are on long supply chains, can be extremely vulnerable to even mild disruptions, and they are long past that point now. What are the effects of such disruption? Urban centers, which rely on the rapid transportation and delivery of goods, cannot feed their populations. Are these supply chains still functioning? Is the power still on in the major cities? Is clean water still readily available? If this fails, then there is a serious risk of the outbreak of communicable disease. Famine, thirst, plague. Truly, this would be the end of days. Our knowledge of conditions on Romulus is limited. Receiving good intelligence was always difficult even in the best of circumstances. My understanding is that we still have some agents on Romulus, but it becomes harder to justify their continued presence there, given the imminent risk. Interestingly, Rafi is of the opinion that our intelligence has become slightly better in recent months, but that this is one further sign that Romulus is in deep and serious trouble. She suspects that as the strains on the Romulan government and the flow of refugees outward become ever greater, information has become harder for the authorities to control. As a result, we are able to learn much more than we ever did in the past, and much more than the Romulan government would like. They are no longer able to contain the leaks. Nevertheless, despite all evidence to the contrary, the Romulan government insists that their ongoing evacuation effort of the homeworld is proceeding steadily and within necessary timeframes. Admiral Bordson has told me of several tense conversations with Ambassador Sulde in which she flatly denies that any help is needed on Romulus. I am sympathetic to the desire to save face, but I simply do not believe Sulde. Whether they are lying to us or deluding themselves, it is clear to me that Romulus is now on the brink, and only a concerted evacuation effort can save what remains of the population still there. But the call has not come. At all times I try to remember the Romulan predisposition towards secrecy, and that there are still many gaps in our intelligence as to the operations of the Romulan military and the Tal Shiar. It is my fervent hope that one or both of these groups is coordinating evacuation operations that we know nothing about. But my heart tells me that they are no longer able to marshal the resources to do this. At some point, Starfleet will be asked to help. I cannot imagine the devastation, the loss of life, if the Romulan authorities would prefer to save face rather than save their fellow citizens. I cannot believe that the plan has never been to evacuate their people, but to leave them to their eventual and inevitable fate. Rafi, I should note, does not find this difficult to believe. I have noticed, particularly since the tragic events of Nimbus 3, a hardening of the commander's attitude toward the people whom we are trying to help. Let me correct this. I have noted no change in Rafi's desire to help ordinary Romulan people, but it is plain
that her opinion of the Romulan authorities, government, military, and Tal Shiar, has lowered considerably during the past year. Thinking about how matters must be on Romulus, and how we stand ready to help, but remain unasked, it is hard not to agree with Rafi. But I must continue to hope that we will persuade the Romulan authorities that we are their friends, or at least, that we are not their enemies.
Federation Council, Paris, Earth. The popularity of politicians will rise and fall. Olivia Quest, 3 years into her time as a Federation counselor, was discovering that one cannot remain the people's darling indefinitely. To her credit, she was not caught unawares. Since her visit to the Daystrom Institute, she had spoken on numerous occasions and with great enthusiasm about the synthetics program. Upon reflection, she could see that to an outsider, it signaled a significant shift in her position, even allying her with the factions within Starfleet that insisted that the Romulan relief mission should continue at the same pace. She tasked her aides to conduct some quiet polling, and the results were a wake-up call. A worrying number of people on Estolin, whom she depended on to keep her job, were starting to say that she had gone native. Her time on Earth had turned her into yet another Federation lackey, out of touch with her homeworld. Quest did not intend to lose the forthcoming election, and if that meant listening to her constituents and not to her colleagues, then she was prepared to do just that. Taking advantage of the yearly council recess, she traveled back home and spent the break touring the major conurbations on Estolin and its moons. She held town hall meetings, took the reprimands from her constituents. She heard what people were saying and told them she would return to Earth with their interests foremost in her heart. She was too canny an operator not to also further her own goals. After some considerable wrangling, she was able to take home a Daystrom A500. She presented it at separate meetings of farm managers and terraformers and asked them to think about what these machines could do for them. And when she saw their amazement at these creations and the gleam of understanding about how their productivity might be transformed, she secretly thanked Bruce Maddox for his work on her behalf. She returned to Earth for the new council session, determined to balance these competing demands and find a way through that would satisfy her constituents' disgruntlement with the relief mission while discovering ways to expand the synthetics program for them. Could there be a way to sever the synthetics program from the relief mission? She found that during her time at home, momentum against the mission had certainly grown. When she arrived back at her office in Paris, her aide sat her down. "Liv," he said, "things have gone crazy while you were away. The representative for Dorax wants to see you." Dorax was a small Federation world like Estolin. Far from Sol, close to the neutral zone, its population alarmed about the continued diversion of resources toward the Romulans. "Let's get him in here as quickly as we can." The Doraxian counselor, Thaby, was in her office the following morning, and he was not alone. He had brought three others with him, two other representatives from outlying worlds, and a vividly beautiful androgyne from a species that Quest did not recognize. Thaby introduced this person as Vakti, an ambassador from the unaligned neutral zone border world Intassa, which was not a member of the Federation. All were deeply concerned about the Federation's increasing involvement in the Romulan crisis. But why, thought Quest, was Vakti here?
"You said it yourself, Olivia," Thaby said.
He was a thin, rather worried-looking man whose hands moved nervously throughout the conversation.
"This mission is a strain on resources. Transport ships to Dorax have been halved in the last 2 years. The ships have all been pulled away to the Romulan effort."
"We're not saying," said one of the other counselors, a felinoid named Inkine, "that they don't need relocating. Of course they do. We're not monsters. We don't want them to die. But at what cost? It won't be the Big Four that pay, will it? It will be worlds like ours."
You know that I understand, said Quest. I understand completely. You seem to have been distracted recently by those damn synths, Thaby said. Only because I think we can use them, Quest said quickly. I am absolutely committed to ensuring our voice is heard at the top levels. The other counselors exchanged a look. The fact is, we're not sure whether we want a voice any longer, Thaby said. He glanced at Vukti. We've been exploring the possibility of secession. Quest didn't blink.
Secession?
That's a drastic solution to our troubles. But it's one that we should think about, said Thaby. Consider our worlds, Olivia. All on the border. I know Estalyn was settled by humans, and I appreciate that the cultural ties to Earth are strong. But some of us joined the Federation because we thought we were becoming equal partners in a great collaboration. But as far as we can see, it's the Big Four running the show, and they've got more in common with the Romulans than with us.
But secession, said Quest.
Even saying it sounded faintly treasonable. Why should the idea be unthinkable? What power prevented her from even wanting to think about this as a possibility? Ambassador Vukti, she said, forgive me if this sounds mistrustful, but what exactly is in this for you? Vukti looked at her with silver, unblinking eyes. Hard to read. Quest wasn't sure what to make of it.
I want to assure you, said Vukti, that I am not here to cause strife. My world has a great deal in common with yours. We are small. We are agricultural. We trade widely both within the Federation and beyond. We were approached nearly a century ago about the possibility of admission to the Federation, and we debated the idea thoroughly. In the end, we chose to remain outside of the Federation because we were afraid of cultural contamination. We were afraid of Romulan invasion, yes, but that is no longer a threat. They are no longer a power. The neutral zone is breached. In 5 years, the border will be transformed. It's wise for the worlds who will be most affected to look to each other rather than to another power to ensure mutual aid and protection. Quest folded her hands in front of her. It was a bold vision, she thought. What would be best for Estalyn? I have to think about this, she said. At the very least, it might be possible to use the idea of secession as leverage. Persuade the powers that be, whether in the Council or Starfleet, that something had to change. By all means, think about it, said Thaby, but you must bear in mind, we are not the only people thinking this way. Momentum is growing. Counselors from a half dozen planets have approached me to discuss secession. And think about your own world, Counselor. Things are changing. Starfleet has overreached. The Federation has overreached. Perhaps the days of the Federation are done. We should look to our own worlds, take care of ourselves, and find allies closer to home.
Read the mood carefully, Olivia, said Inkine, green eyes glowing. Starfleet, the Federation. With each decision they make, each ship they divert to this mission, each project they start that aims to aid the Romulans, they are telling us that we are of less importance to them than a long-standing enemy. Perhaps it's time to break, truly. Stand up for ourselves. Stand with each other.
Like you say all the time, Romulan space is best for Romulans, said Thaby, and perhaps our worlds are best for us.
And I am here to assure you that you have friends outside of the Federation, said Vukti. If you choose to leave, we will be there.
When the group left, Quest sat with her mind reeling.
Secession.
She had not seen that coming. It was almost unthinkable.
Could it be done? Would it be best?
She thought carefully. Thaby had said something about Estalyn being a human colony and the cultural ties to the Federation being strong. That gave her pause. In her heart, Quest was not sure that she would countenance the idea of leaving the Federation. Many of them made trips back to Earth at some point. They looked up their family trees. They visited the cities and countries that their ancestors had left. Yes, those ties were strong, and her instincts told her that she could not sell this, at least not without careful preparation. In the meantime, Estelin's continued involvement in the Federation was worthwhile, and that in turn meant that she needed to show some concrete benefits, and soon. A diversion of resources away from the mission and back to the borders. Starfleet brass had controlled the narrative on this for far too long. It was time to think the unthinkable, say the unsayable. It was time to debate this mission, debate the fundamentals, and let the Council speak. Quickly, she wrote out the motion and sent it for consideration. By the end of the day, the debate was timetabled. The Romulan crisis is a domestic matter. Starfleet's involvement has exceeded its mandate and should be immediately scaled back. This might be the thing that stopped these secessions from happening, the thing that could stop the breakup of the Federation. Starfleet Command, San Francisco, Earth. Captain Kirsten Clancy, sitting in her office following the debate, heard Counselor Inkine say the word secession. She thought at first that the universal translator had failed. Then she began to believe that she had just seen the opening move that would lead to the Federation's demise. For a moment, she glimpsed that future. Hundreds of worlds, rudderless, each out for their own gain, pressing their own advantage and treating each other as competitors rather than partners. Hostility. Suspicion. Chaos. War. Clancy, practical and unemotional, dedicated and intelligent, damped down the sentiment immediately. She was damned if that was going to happen on her watch. One eye still on the screen, one ear still following the speeches, she began scribbling a list of people whom she needed to see and stat. Border World Representatives. Inkine. Thaby. She made a note to ask Starfleet Intelligence how the unaligned border worlds were reporting all this. Then, Inkine said, "Romulan space for the Romulans." "Christ," Clancy said, and threw down her pad. That damn phrase was everywhere these days. She loathed it, loathed the subtle undercurrent of racism, loathed how it was invariably followed up by the statement, "Oh, it's not that I want them to die. I simply think it's their own business." Damn it, hadn't people got it yet? If Starfleet wasn't there, then all those people would die. Her comm chimed. It was the CNC. "Kirsten, are you watching this?" "Damn right I am. I've asked Picard to speak to us later today. I'm clearing my damn schedule. This is all extremely concerning. It's a damn fucking mess." Bordson blinked. "Kirsten, I have never heard you swear this much. Take it as a mark of how fucking deep my concern runs, sir." Clancy spent the rest of the day chasing meetings and taking soundings. By the time she went to join Bordson for their conference with Picard, she was by no means in the best of moods. She listened to the careful and measured discussions of the two men with increasing annoyance. "All of this is irrelevant compared to the true purpose of this mission," said Picard. "The rescue of people in need." Clancy couldn't believe what she was hearing. She imagined the dinosaurs looking up at the asteroid thinking, "Perhaps we can be friends." She leaned forward to speak, but Bordson was already talking. "I'm afraid that things are changing rapidly here, Jean-Luc." That was phrased considerably more politely than she could have managed, but it was the basic point they needed to get through to him.
"They are changing rapidly in Romulan space, too, and not for the better."
Nope, it hadn't gotten through.
"And while I continue to be sympathetic to their plight, I am saddened to say that for many people in the Federation, this is less and less true. I understand. Smaller worlds on the border finding that promised resources have not materialized. Some of these worlds have suffered at Romulan hands in the past."
Picard was shaking his head.
Then they must put aside their grievances, listen to the better angels of their nature, and make a sacrifice that is necessary for others to survive.
Nobody, said Clancy, wins elections telling people to make sacrifices.
Picard was looking at her as if she were speaking a language that his universal translator could not parse.
I fail to see the relevance.
She shifted impatiently in her seat.
There are worlds now threatening to secede. The idea is gaining momentum. If the Federation won't look after us, we'll look after each other.
Secede? That would be an entirely irrational decision. They are manifestly better inside the Federation than out.
These decisions aren't made rationally, sir, she said. They're coming from anger and resentment. They come from a growing sense of tribalism. You hear anti-Romulan sentiment even on Earth, in places you wouldn't believe.
We cannot base our response to this mission on such sentiments.
No, said Bordson, calmly intervening, his hand placed upon Clancy's arm. But others will. We gain nothing by ignoring such sentiments or allowing them to fester and gain ground.
Would you pander to xenophobia?
I would not, said Bordson sharply for him. But the mission needs a big win, Jean-Luc.
Vashti, he said immediately.
Old news, said Clancy. We need more. Happy Romulan children, smiling Starfleet officers, Federation citizens welcoming them with open arms.
Picard's look, she saw, was pure distaste. She felt a flash of anger.
Rather coarsely put, Kirsten, said Bordson. But the sentiment is correct. We need another Vashti.
Surely it wasn't unique, Clancy said.
I understand. Verity out.
Bordson eyed her thoughtfully.
You think we need more, don't you?
It's not that I think we need more, Victor, but that I think this mission is going to become increasingly difficult to sell. The concerns that these people have, they're reasonable. I said this at the start. We were getting ourselves involved in a project that had no clear end date and might expand in ways we couldn't foresee. And it has. The whole of the Martian shipbuilding facilities pulled into the service of this mission. A generation of Starfleet officers and civil servants all working on this. We've invented a new form of synthetic life. We're 5 years into this, and the mission is still growing.
He was listening. Your advice?
I advise that we start putting some resources back into Federation projects.
Picard isn't going to like that.
Picard, said Clancy, is going to have to lump it.
Bordson sat for a while, deep in thought.
Secession, he said at last. Do they mean it? Or is it a bluff?
I think we should meet with these people. Talk to them. In the meantime, I'm going to see what we can pull back. People, ships, replicators, printers. Not the whole mission, but something. Enough to make them understand that we're listening.
She looked at him. Do you want to take the meeting with Quest, or shall I?
I think, he said, you should handle her.
Verity. Picard received with some anger the news that a dozen ships, 300 staff, and 5 industrial replicators were to be pulled. They were going to support infrastructure projects on remote worlds. The decision had plainly been taken without consideration to his objections. Therefore, all he could do was mitigate its effects. He suggested that the use of these resources might be contingent on the recipient worlds aiding Romulan refugees, whereby, when a new transport came online, the worlds would agree to take a few thousand settlers. Clancy quashed this idea at once. Indeed, he thought she quashed it with unusual vigor.
Are you kidding me? She said. I put that to the counselors for Dorax, and they'll secede on the spot.
Picard was at a loss to understand why this idea met with such resistance. It had struck him as a rather elegant solution. Privately, he believed that these mutterings about secession were no more than empty threats.
Who would dare leave the Federation? Who would willingly exile themselves from this great, diverse community of worlds, each seeking to benefit the other both materially and culturally? These worlds would be forced to rely on only their own resources during a deeply uncertain time. Nevertheless, he knew that Clancy was closer to the politicians and reluctantly accepted what he was sure would be a short period of retrenchment. He also held numerous conversations with LaForge about how the shortfall in ships might be made up.
"That depends on Maddox," said LaForge, "and how soon he can get this new batch of A-500s to me."
"Is there a problem, Geordi?"
"No, but the work has slowed down. You know Maddox, he gets distracted."
"Then he must undistract himself," said Picard acerbically.
"I'll send him that message," said LaForge, "and I'll say it comes straight from you." Clancy's parting shot in their previous conversation was preoccupying Picard. Was Vashti unique, then? Once again, the grind of the mission began to wear at him. The slow procession of lost souls clutching all they could carry. Would the children ever recover? Was the damage, the trauma, too great? He found himself researching everything that was known about the psychology of Romulan trauma. Ignoring Clancy's pleas not to add personnel, he requested that Bowie recruit psychologists to begin longitudinal studies of the Romulan settlers in Federation space. He fretted over the cabin layouts. Did they do enough to mitigate stress? Rafi indulged him at first, but he knew she was starting to become impatient. He turned to Zani, hoping she could provide answers he could not see.
"I fear we have done unwitting damage," he confessed to her. "I fear Starfleet may have created wounds that will never heal."
"What would you have done differently?" Zani said. He pondered this. He might wish that events on Nimbus 3 had not ended in the way that they had, but he could not see what he could have done.
"Nothing," he said.
"Then what can I say other than act honestly and listen honestly?"
Was that a rebuke? Did he sometimes not listen honestly? He believed that he was a thoughtful man, a compassionate man, one who tried to take all opinions into account. Nevertheless, he was grateful for her counsel and for her friendship. He did not, he could not believe that such a friendship was unique, that among their peoples they were the only two who understood each other. There had to be others who could put everything aside and do the right, the necessary thing. Picard received a request for another conference with Admiral Bordson with some trepidation, fearing that there would be more bad news, further demand for retrenchment to placate the isolationist elements that seemed to be emerging across the Federation.
"Admiral Picard," said Bordson, "I'm patched in with Ambassador Sulde in Paris."
The Romulan ambassador to the Federation, Picard thought. What could this mean?
Sulda's face appeared on screen. Picard had not dealt with her. That had been Victor Bordson's duty. His impression of her in the vids that he had seen was of a controlled, canny, and extremely suave woman. This was not how she appeared today. There was an air of exhaustion, and, yes, grief about her, that she could not hide.
"Ambassador Sulde," he said, "how may I help?"
"Help," she said, and a bitter smile passed across her lips. "Admiral, I have been authorized by my government to request Starfleet's assistance in the evacuation of Romulus. We—" She halted, as if the words stuck in her throat, and lifted her hand to press it against her mouth. Picard watched with compassion as she gathered the tatters of her dignity. "We are no longer able to keep pace with the need." Picard nodded. He hated this. He hated to see these proud people brought low. He remembered what Coley used to say. "We must not let the Romulans become the beggars of two quadrants." He had no desire for that, no taste for it.
All he wanted was to bring Sulda's people to safety, to allow them to live, and perhaps to prove to the Romulans beyond doubt that the Federation were their friends.
Jolan True, Ambassador, he said, we honor your people. We honor the sanctity and the privacy of your homes. We understand how hard this request must be. I promise you our help and our discretion.
He glanced at Bordson.
Do you wish our fleet to proceed to Romulus itself?
Sulda looked away, her eyes down. That is not possible. No, thought Picard, he had suspected not.
Then where, Ambassador? Our fleet is at your service.
The Jura, she said.
Picard knew the world. It was in the next system along from the Romulan star, one of the most populated, settled worlds beyond the home system.
How advanced is the evacuation?
She did not look at him. It has not yet begun.
He thought he heard Bordson murmur something. I see, Ambassador. We shall do all we can.
She did not speak, but touched her mouth and her heart. Then she was gone. Bordson remained on the channel.
I've never seen her like that before. Well, I hope never to see her like that again. The situation must be desperate, Jean-Luc. What the hell is happening there?
Picard thought of the many worlds that he had seen so far. He thought of the conditions on some of the worlds where his fleet had been. They had faced floods and fires. They had brought medical aid to places where plagues and diseases had taken advantage of squalor and crowding and lack of clean water. They had helped bury the dead. How much bigger this disaster would be. The sheer numbers involved.
We will try to meet the need, Victor. Will you help us?
However I can.
There can be no half measures, Picard warned. We need every resource. Most of all, we need the ships.
His commander-in-chief nodded.
I am doing everything I can. In the meantime, Godspeed and good luck.
Picard sat alone for a while and contemplated the gravity of this new mission. He was about to send a message to Zani when the door to his ready room chimed.
Enter.
It was Tajuth.
You've heard?
Yes.
Tajuth circled the room, eyeing Picard warily and refusing the offer of a seat. At last he said,
Will your people make political capital from this?
Picard leaned back in his chair. He held his hands out.
My people? You know what I mean. You are politicians. I cannot control what the politicians do, said Picard. But my superiors want to help, as do I. You know that already.
He watched Tajuth struggle to maintain his composure.
A big win, he said. Isn't that what your superiors want?
The Tal Shiar's sources of information were still solid, Picard thought. Or Tajuth simply knew his enemy.
Yes, he said. That's what they say to me. I'm never entirely sure what they mean. Each life saved counts as a victory as far as I'm concerned. Let me guess, then, said Tajuth. Holocameras. Romulans falling gratefully into Federation arms, thanking their saviors.
He was angry.
And for those images to come from so close to Romulus itself, even better. None of that will happen with my permission, said Picard. You have my word.
Tajuth gave a bitter laugh.
That I should believe the promise of a Starfleet officer, he said. How far we have fallen indeed.
Picard studied him thoughtfully and with compassion.
Why do you loathe us so much? He said. After all this, is there anything more that we could have done? I wish only for there to be friendship between our peoples. That is not a possibility, Tajuth said. There's too much history. Too much mistrust.
he made for the door.
But beggars cannot be choosers.
Federation Council, Paris, Earth. Kirsten Clancy took the meeting with Olivia Quest. She even went so far as to go to Quest's territory, her office in the Federation Council chambers. She wished for a better day. When Clancy stepped out of the transporter across the square from the great building, Paris was wet. The sky was cloudy and gray. The city of lights dimmed. Quest welcomed her into her private office with some reservation. Clancy accepted the offer of coffee. She apologized for the weather.
"You should stay a day or two," she said. "Tomorrow might be very different."
Clancy shook her head.
"I'd like to, but there's too much happening."
Quest gave a closed smile.
"I wondered why you were here."
"The council will be informed within the hour, but it seemed courteous to come and speak to you first, given your, Clancy looked out at the blurred sky. "Your particular interest in the Romulan relief mission."
"You're canceling the whole thing," Quest deadpanned.
"I'm afraid not," said Clancy. "We've been asked for further assistance in the evacuation. Vajura, the most populated world in the next system along from Romulus." Quest stood up and walked across to the window.
"By whom?"
"Ambassador Sulda."
"Ah," said Quest. "A genuine request, then."
"And one made in desperation. Starfleet is helping."
"Of course you are," said Quest.
Clancy put down her cup. Truth was, she'd had enough coffee today already. "I've no idea how you intend to play this," she said, "because try as I might, I'm never quite able to grasp what motivates you."
"Serving Estelin motivates me."
"Sure, yes, absolutely," said Clancy. "But what else floats your boat, Counselor? I don't quite see. You like to be at the center of things, I know that. Fair enough. I think you're right when you say the Federation has taken some of these small worlds for granted."
"That's heartening to hear."
"But you like to gamble, don't you? Or keep your options open. I don't think you have any intention of pushing for Estelin to secede, swapping a large stage for a very small one. Not in its interest, not in your interests. But those other worlds, you won't stop them if they want to go, will you?"
"They are free to make their own decisions."
"I'm here to try to alleviate your fears about the mission. But the problem with that is, I'm not sure what they are. I don't think you're afraid of much." Quest turned to look at her. Very cool. Very untroubled.
"No," she said. "Not much."
"Let me speak freely. We're going to help the Romulans. We're working flat out on Mars to make sure we have more ships. Same at the Daystrom Institute, trying to get enough synths out. We're pulling everything back into this, not only because the idea of the Star Empire collapsing entirely and the chaos that would follow keeps me awake at night, but also because it's the right thing to do." Quest lifted a hand.
"You're pulling everything back in?"
"For the next few months, at least. Is that going to be a problem?"
"From me? No."
The captain, who had expected resistance, was momentarily stunned. Then she got it.
"I see," she said. "I gain nothing," said Quest, "by being seen to block this. What kind of monster would do that?"
"No," agreed Clancy. "That would make for some bad optics."
"The fact is," said Quest, "that this mission cannot go on indefinitely. At some point, the Romulan star will go supernova, but that's not the end of it. It's what comes after that concerns me."
"Damn," thought Clancy. "She's cold." "What's your expectation?"
"In other words, Counselor, what's your price?"
"I'll think of something," Quest said. She reached out her hand, which Clancy, after a moment, shook. "Thank you for coming to see me today, Captain Clancy. I'm sure this is a very busy time. I'll be in touch." Clancy, chilled, made for the door.
Quest called after her. I can give you my word that I won't speak against the expansion of the mission. But you must understand that I do not control the counselors for other worlds. They might think differently. And remember, Captain, at some point, this all has to come to an end. Clancy walked back through the rain to the transporter. Did I just give everything away? The trouble was that she couldn't be sure. Verity, approaching Vajura. As the first of 30 Starfleet ships entered the Vajuran system, a small vessel asked permission to pass through local space on the way back to Federation. Picard had a suspicion who this was, and, if his guess was correct, any remaining hope he held out for the situation on Romulus was now completely dashed. The passenger on that little ship would not have left before the end. Lieutenant Marshall, on comms, took an incoming message. Admiral, she said, there's a message for you. Sir, it's... But he already knew who it was.
I'll take it in my ready room.
Picard opened the channel as soon as he was alone.
Ambassador Spock, he said as the Vulcan's face appeared on screen. How are things on Romulus? As bad as we fear?
That and more, Admiral.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
I have stayed as long as I dared, but I have my own people to consider. They must be taken to safety.
You'll have no trouble entering Federation space, Ambassador. We'll make sure of that.
Thank you. And I have a request to make, Admiral.
Whatever I can do.
You will find that the elites will demand to leave first. I have brought on this vessel a small number of vulnerable people. But there are many more on Romulus. They have already been betrayed by their leaders, and my fear is that they are facing further betrayals. Do all you can to assist them.
You have my word, Ambassador.
Then live long, Admiral, Spock said, and prosper.
Verity. Rafi Musiker, more than a little drunk, stumbled back toward her quarters. I'm not coming home for a while, she'd said to Jay earlier that evening. We're going to Vajura. Jay had said, I don't think you should come back. And she'd said, like a fool, from Vajura? It's going to burn to a crisp, Jay.
I mean home, Rafi. She didn't know how to respond. She tried,
Excuse me?
We've moved on, Rafi. Gabe and I. We're done waiting. We can't wait forever.
Jeez, Jay, this has come from nowhere.
No, it has not.
And the problem is that you don't see that, do you? Rafi, this has been years in the making.
What followed had not been very dignified. Neither of them had covered themselves in glory. Eventually, Jay had cut the comm. She had yelled, Fuck you! She guessed that meant the marriage was in difficulty, huh? Anyway, there was no point brooding, so she got out of her quarters and headed down to the officer's mess and found something close to scotch, and she drank most of that pretty quickly. And now she was staggering back to her quarters.
Hell, this quarter seems so long all of a sudden.
She stumbled. She started crashing down. Something stopped her hitting the deck. Bleary-eyed, she found herself staring up into the face of the enemy.
Might I suggest, said Tajuth, that you get yourself back to quarters, Commander. You should not be seen by anyone.
Fuck you, muttered Rafi.
It came out garbled. That was when she began to realize exactly how drunk she was. Incredibly drunk. She glared at Tajuth. He had one hand pressed against the wall. She sniffed and caught the scent of something vinous.
Hey, she said. I'm not the only one, am I?
No, said Tajuth.
He gripped her arm and started walking her down the corridor. She wasn't quite sure who was propping up whom. After a brief shuffle, they reached the door to her quarters. As she thumped in the key code, he leaned against the wall.
My world is about to end. What's your excuse, Commander Musiker?
He didn't wait for an answer. He pulled himself up straight and stumbled off.
My excuse? Same as yours.
She fell into her quarters and onto the bed.
This damn mission. It'll eat us all up and spit us out.
12. Admiral's Log. Throughout this mission, we have struggled with the Romulan need for secrecy and privacy, and with their understandable desire to save face. I have tried to respect their autonomy within the goal of this mission, to protect and preserve life. I have made decisions that have overthrown treaties, redrawn the boundaries, and brought hundreds of thousands of Romulans into Federation space. I have learned that my decisions have threatened the very essence of the Federation, bringing some worlds to the brink of secession. I have gone as far as I dared, and perhaps, on occasion, beyond what is justified. But now, confronted with the situation on the Romulan homeworld, I know that I should have gone further, sooner, and with less doubt in my heart. We trusted that the Romulans were helping their own. As soon as we arrived on Verjura, I could see the extent to which they have not. Whether through denial, incompetence, or an inability to meet the vast requirements, or simply because they did not care, the Romulan government's plans to evacuate this world have been entirely insufficient. I am aware that details of the ultimate impact of the supernova have been kept from ordinary Romulans, and I sympathize with the desire to prevent panic. But there must have come a point, long past, when it was clear that something on Romulus was going horribly wrong. Yet many people, even among the elites, most of whom have been privy to the information, seem not to have believed the evidence of their own eyes. They seem to have wantonly refused to connect the dots between the increasing heat, the storms, the floods, and the freak weather pattern. I struggled to understand why. Perhaps some truths are simply too much to face. Perhaps the Romulan habit of secrecy and compartmentalization is so deeply ingrained that Romulans are psychologically able to believe that there is more than one truth. Perhaps people have been too afraid to confront the reality, not only because speaking out might carry sanctions, but because the truth is too terrible to admit. As a result, many of the elites have preferred to continue as usual. If the situation were so bad, they seem to have told each other, then our government would be doing something. Their government has not. Their government has failed. Moreover, most members of the government are not to be found. The messages we receive from high-ranking officials come from systems away, well beyond the blast radius. The very highest echelons seem to have persuaded the rest of the population that they are not at risk, ostensibly to prevent rioting and keep order, while simultaneously ensuring their own escape. I do not know whether this counts as a crime under Romulan law, but I believe wholeheartedly that these decisions and actions are immoral, an abnegation of duty and responsibility that may yet lead to the deaths of many hundreds of thousands of people, if not more. I am grateful that someone within the Romulan government has seen sense and turned to us for assistance. I can only guess at what has happened behind the scenes, what deals have been struck, what offers made, what promises given. Let those involved trouble themselves with this. My own concern now is that our arrival has come desperately late. We are running out of time. Romulus is doomed, and many more places besides. Whoever remains on these sad lost worlds is also doomed. How does one help in an apocalypse? What does one do? One does one's best.
Ojul City, Verjura. Rafi Musiker woke each morning to look out across a city of the damned. She had worried sometimes throughout this mission that she was becoming inured to the sight of the pain of others. She worried that she was becoming blasé, that nothing could shock her anymore. She had raised this once, and only once, with J.L. He suggested counseling. As if that was ever going to happen. No way. But Rafi could sense within herself a kind of strange distance growing. Sometimes, when she was in the thick of things, she would feel herself detach from proceedings as if she were floating above. She listened to words coming out of her mouth, orders, reflections, suggestions, and marveled at how good she had become at this job. Like a machine. She found that she spent more of her off-duty hours alone in her quarters, scrolling through intelligence reports. Drinking. Not that she was drinking that much. Maybe. Never mind, she was doing fine, wasn't she? Yes, she was doing fine. The main part of the fleet had arrived at Vajura 3 weeks ago. 2 weeks had been spent wrangling with the local authorities to get permission to set up a base of operations. 8 days ago, J.L. decided enough was enough and instructed that the damn structure should be put up without any damn permission, and if they didn't like it, they could damn well live with it. J.L. resorting to even the mildest curse was a call to arms. 20 hours later, a record for the mission, but then they'd had a lot of practice, United Federation of Planets High Commission on Refugees HQ Ojul City was standing. 8 prefabricated plasticrete rooms, transported from the Verity, put together rapidly, and filled with the workstations, comms units, and myriad specialist staff needed to start processing people off-world and onto the fleet of ships in orbit overhead. At last, they were able to get to work. 2 days later, a squad of 8 armed police arrived to take the building down. Rafi, looking below at them from the roof of HQ, thought they were a pretty sorry bunch. Most of them looked like kids, not much older than Gabe was now. They seemed unhappy, as if they wanted to be somewhere else. Something everyone had in common around here. Their leader, however, was different. Rafi knew his type. A thug, motivating his unwilling troops chiefly through threats of violence. Still, it was an effective technique in the short term, and it had the potential to make things nasty. Rafi, coming down from the roof, went in search of Tajuth.
"We're going to need your help here, Commander."
Tajuth said,
"Let's wait a minute or two."
They stood together and looked out from an open second-story window. From the moment that the base had started construction, people had begun to arrive. The news that Starfleet was here had clearly gone around the city. By word of mouth, Rafi assumed, since the local castes were rubbish. Sentimental holodramas and advertisements for holidays on the coast. Did anyone believe any of this? It infuriated her. They should be advising on where to go for help, telling them what they needed to pack for the journey, directing them to the nearest relief center. It wasn't as if this anodyne crap was keeping people calm any longer. They got reports of riots every day. People were on the move, whatever the government was saying. Even before the HQ was finished, there were hundreds camped outside, each wanting to be first in line. By the time the police squad arrived, there must have been nearly 2,000 there.
Damn, Rafi thought. They are a pitiful sight.
Family groups, possessions strapped on their back, leaving hands free to keep hold of their kids. Rafi's heart clenched at the sight. Some of those little ones, you lost hold of one of them in this chaos, you'd never find them again. Rafi thought of Gabe at that age, his small hand within hers. She thought of him slipping away. The most striking thing about the encampment was how subdued it was. People weren't fighting or jostling for position or making demands or getting into fights. They were simply waiting. And then the squad arrived. They shoved their way to the front, where a fence separated the HQ building from the camp, letting them siphon the flood of refugees into a steady trickle that went through a gate, past the desk, and to transporters beyond. The squad leader rattled the gate. He began to shout,
"Open up!"
And then the damn idiot started to explain why he was there.
This is an illegal installation. You must open up and remove this facility.
Rafi watched as word passed around the camp. Turning to Tajuth, she said,
Holy shit, this is going to be a bloodbath.
I don't think so, said Tajuth. Watch.
Within the crowd, people were rippling forward. 5, 10, 15 huge Romulans. Blue collar, Rafi saw. Worn clothes, hard faces. People who had worked like hell their whole lives, who had been left behind to burn in it. They pressed forward to the gate and, without any words, formed a barrier between the squad and the crowd. One of them shifted forward, their ringleader, and began to speak to the officer. He lifted his disruptor and pointed it straight at the ringleader.
Shit, said Rafi. Tajuth, we need to do something.
Wait.
Everything paused for a moment. The ringleader turned his head away from the squad leader and looked at the kids that had come with him, one by one. Something got through. One of the young men, hands trembling, lowered his disruptor. He gripped it by its snub nose and held it out, offering it to the ringleader. The others, they were so young, these boys, this could be Gabe, stared at him open-mouthed. One by one, the others followed suit. Soon, only their officer was armed, and he was looking down the barrel of 7 disruptors. The ringleader gestured to him to hand over his weapon. Rafi thought for a moment that he wasn't going to do it, but then those guys were very big. He did what he was told and slunk away. The crowd shifted, opening up a path for him to leave, staring at him as he hurried through. The boys from the squad stared blinking and terrified at the ringleader and his men. Then, one of them pulled off his gear and melted into the crowd. Soon they were all gone. The ringleader and the others exchanged a few quiet words, and then they too slipped away, hidden and protected. Rafi relaxed. She glanced at Tajuth, who stood motionless, arms folded.
That was a gamble, she said. At least you haven't had to pull Tal Shiar from elsewhere.
No, he agreed. I doubt I could have found anyone in time.
He turned and walked away. Rafi, watching him, processed the ramifications of what he'd said. The glimpse into the power vacuum that she had been dropped into. It was all one great almighty clusterfuck. And it was only ever going to get worse. Verity. In orbit over Vajura. Picard wearily took his seat behind his desk, activated his comm, and drank a mouthful of tea. The Starfleet logo dissolved, and Admiral Victor Bordson appeared on screen.
Jean-Luc, you look tired.
A long day, Victor.
Any good news?
Picard pondered this request. What constituted good news these days? A riot prevented? An outbreak of a waterborne fever detected and the carriers quarantined just in time? A lost child reunited with relatives on board the ship? An official's anger over some imagined slight deflected?
I was about to ask you the same question.
Let me see. I have found another 2 ships which will be with you within the week.
2. A drop in the ocean.
Thank you.
Kirsten has somehow persuaded Olivia Quest not to block these emergency requisitions.
Has she? I wouldn't like to think what that has cost.
I imagine we shall learn in time.
Picard rubbed his eyes.
I received your reports, Jean-Luc. Tell me exactly, how bad is it?
How bad? They had no idea.
Whatever you are imagining. You should increase it 1,000-fold.
I was on Cardassia Prime after the war.
That must have been hell. This is worse, Victor. So much of what we face could have been prevented if we had been asked sooner. But no, the self-respect of the Romulan elites had to be upheld at all costs. But they are not the ones paying for it. Most of them are gone. The ones suffering are the ones without power, and they are now beginning to understand the nature and the depth of that treachery.
Bordson had been listening with compassion. "Tell me," he said, "in all honesty and in complete confidentiality,